readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and yes, unbelievably, it's holiday shopping time. It's my privilege and pleasure to take some of the stress out of your shopping and offer up books guaranteed to bring a smile to folks on your list. The good news is that Santa's bookshelves are overflowing with new titles, some obvious, some offbeat, for animal lovers, techno geeks, history buffs, and more. And I'll be speaking with a very popular author whose books are at the top of many lists. So get ready for some very merry inspiration as we turn to page one of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Here's the book being featured front and center on every bookstand I've passed, Steve Jobs, The Exclusive Biography. Based on more than 40 interviews with Jobs conducted over 2 years, as well as interviews with more than 100 family members, friends, adversaries, competitors, and colleagues, Walter Isaacson, author of the best-selling biographies of Benjamin Franklin and Albert Einstein, has written a riveting story of the roller coaster life and intense personality of a creative entrepreneur. At a time when America is seeking ways to sustain its innovative edge, Jobs stands as the ultimate icon of inventiveness. He built a company where leaps of the imagination were combined with remarkable feats of engineering. His passion for perfection revolutionized personal computers, animated movies, music, phones, and so much more. Although Jobs cooperated with the book, he asked for no control over what was written, nor even the right to read it before it was published. Nothing was off limits. Jobs encouraged the people he knew to speak honestly, and he spoke candidly, sometimes brutally so, about the people he worked with and competed against. His friends, his foes, his colleagues provide an unvarnished view of the passions, perfectionism, obsessions, artistry, and compulsion for control that shaped his approach to business. Word of caution, while reader reviews love this book, there are not many kind words for this narrator, Dylan Baker. Perhaps this is the moment to choose the print version.
His persistence baffled me. He was known to guard his privacy, and I had no reason to believe that he'd ever read any of my books. Maybe someday, I continued to say. But in 2009, his wife, Lorene Powell, said bluntly, "If you're ever going to do a book on Steve, you'd better do it now." He had just taken a second medical leave. I confessed to her that when he had first raised the idea, I hadn't even known he was sick. "Almost nobody knew," she said. He had called me right before he was going to be operated on for cancer, and he was still keeping it secret, she explained. I decided then to write this book. Jobs surprised me by readily acknowledging that he would have no control over it, or even the right to see it in advance. "It's your book," he said. "I won't even read it." But later that fall, he seemed to have second thoughts about cooperating, and though I didn't know it, he was hit by another round of cancer complications. He stopped returning my calls, and I put the project aside for a while. Then, unexpectedly, he phoned me late on the afternoon of New Year's Eve of 2009. He was at home in Palo Alto with only his sister, the writer Mona Simpson. His wife and their 3 children had taken a quick trip to go skiing, but he was not healthy enough to join them. He was in a reflective mood, and we talked for more than an hour. He began by recalling that he had wanted to build a frequency counter when he was 12, and he was able to look up Bill Hewlett, the founder of HP, in the phone book and call him to get parts. Jobs said the past 12 years of his life, since his return to Apple, had been his most productive in terms of creating new products. But his more important goal, he said, was to do what Hewlett and his friend David Packard had done, which was to create a company that was so imbued with innovative creativity that it would outlive them. "I always thought of myself as a humanities person as a kid, but I liked electronics," he said. "Then I read something that one of my heroes, Edwin Land of Polaroid, said about the importance of people who could stand at the intersection of humanities and sciences, and I decided that's what I wanted to do." It was as if he were suggesting themes for his biography, and in this case at least, the theme turned out to be valid. The creativity that can occur when a feel for both the humanities and the sciences combine in one strong personality was a topic that most interested me in my biographies of Franklin and Einstein, and I believe that it will be a key to creating innovative economies in the 21st century. I asked Jobs why he wanted me to be the one to write his biography. "I think you're good at getting people to talk," he replied. That was an unexpected answer. I knew that I would have to interview scores of people he had fired, abused, abandoned, or otherwise infuriated, and I feared he would not be comfortable with me getting them to talk. And indeed, he did turn out to be skittish when word trickled back to him of people that I was interviewing. But after a couple of months, he began encouraging people to talk to me, even foes and former girlfriends. Nor did he try to put anything off limits. "I've done a lot of things I'm not proud of, such as getting my girlfriend pregnant when I was 23 and the way I handled that," he said. "But I don't have any skeletons in my closet that can't be allowed out." He didn't seek any control over what I wrote or even ask to read it in advance. His only involvement came when my publisher was choosing the cover art. When he saw an early version of a proposed cover treatment, he disliked it so much that he asked to have input in designing a new version. I was both amused and willing, so I readily assented.
That was Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. Bruce Cameron, my guest today, is currently on book tour for one of the most charming books I've read all year, Emery's Gift. We previewed that title fairly recently. Listen to a sample of it by going to bookreportradio.com, then click on archive shows for the week of September 24th. Bruce was born in Michigan and knew by fourth grade he wanted to be a writer. When he was 16, according to him, the worst thing happened. He sold the very first short story he ever submitted. The Kansas City Star paid him $50 for a story, which sadly remained the most he was ever paid for a story until 1995. Bruce attended Westminster College, then became a freelance writer. As with so many of us, he got a day job to support his writing habit. In his previous life, he had driven an ambulance, repossessed cars, sold life insurance, winemaking equipment, and men's clothing, programmed computers, and analyzed financial statements. And through it all, he would get up at 4:30 in the morning to write before heading off to his day job. In 1995, he decided that after 8 unpublished novels, he was simply never going to be published, and he started writing book number 9 for himself. In 1998, Bruce became a columnist for the Rocky Mountain News. Meanwhile, that book he wrote for himself turned out to be 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, which hit number 14 on the New York Times bestseller list. And then came bestseller Dog's Purpose and now Emery's Gift. Welcome, Bruce. Thanks for taking time out of an incredibly busy book tour to speak with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right. Tell us about the journey that took you from writing about a dog who keeps on being reincarnated to a communicative bear with strange ties to the Civil War.
The journey sort of went like this. I had complete artistic freedom, which you rarely get in any endeavor anymore. Everybody's so worried about marketing, and it's so hard to get anything going. But when Dog's Purpose was in the pipeline, we were looking at the orders, and by we, I mean they, the publisher was looking at the orders, and it's, and they said, Dog's Purpose is going to be a bigger book than we first thought. And they called and wanted to talk to me about my next book. And I said, well, I have this idea. And I started to describe it, and they heard about two sentences and said, great, we'll buy it. So they didn't even really know what they were getting themselves into. I wrote a book that I was completely free to write, and I told a story that I've always wanted to tell, was sort of setting side by side a really profound, complex, and ultimately allegorical situation that affects a 13-year-old boy. And I wanted to explain that when you're 13 years old, what really matters to you is what's right in front of you. And use that as sort of a prism through which to regard all of us when we are affected by things really big and profound in the world. Do we pay attention to them, or do we pay attention to what's right in front of us? Are we more worried about what's for dinner tonight, or are we worried about spiritual or profound questions? And that's Emery's gift. I mean, it was my pleasure to be able to write the story that I've always wanted to tell.
Well, it's an amazing coming-of-age tale, and one of a father and a son who, after a terrible loss, begin to grow their relationship. Okay, why a Civil War connection for the bear?
You know, I get asked that question a lot, and it surprised me. And I think that's what happens to authors a lot, is that we'll write something and not really be cognizant of how it's going to resonate with our readers. So in Emery's Gift, there's several mentions of the Civil War, but what I have to say to that is that it's not as significant as you might think. It was really just necessary to get a few details down that then come all the way back and reconnect to the story in the epilogue. And if you remember, and I don't want to give it away, but if you remember, there's a reference to a book in the epilogue that explains a big part of the history that is mentioned throughout the tale that's involved in Emery's Gift.
Mm. Well, one thing I loved is that Charlie's aches and pains into growing into being a teenager, they're so real. Is there a lot of you in Charlie?
Yeah, there really is. I wanted to write in Emery's Gift, there's a story of a boy that I wanted to write where, unlike most coming-of-age stories that just don't feel real to me, I wanted to write about what it really felt like to me to be 13 years old. That, you know, there is, of course, tons of things, literature out there about coming-of-age sexually. Emery's Gift isn't about that. Emery's Gift picks up the tale of Charlie when he's still in that innocent stage that boys go through, where he's yearning for social connection, he's yearning for a girlfriend, but not necessarily because he's full of chemically fueled lust, but rather just because he's just pining for things. He's you know, he's being affected by certainly the gathering storm of the you know, the hormonal cloud, but it hasn't yet really rained on him. And so I wanted to write about the other stuff, the jostling for position at you know, that level of eighth grade, where boys are, you know, at once they're friends and then they're also fighting each other a little bit, and they're, you know, they're just trying to figure things out. It's really a scary time for everybody, I think. I think for boys, maybe more so than girls, but I don't know. I've never been a girl. As a boy, what I capture in Emery's Gift, which is the scary part of being a young teenager, that was really real for me, too.
Yeah. Well, okay, the book has a very strong message at the end, and many of the readers think it's a spiritual message. Do you want to talk about that? Did you have that message in your head when you began the book?
You know, it's an allegorical tale. If you think about that message and the messenger, you can see that I've drawn pretty strong parallels to another, let's just say, a historic messenger. And I wrote it from the aspect of you don't have to. You can be very devoted to the idea that the messenger was real, or you can be devoted to the idea that he was not. And you can find that in this book. I wrote an allegorical tale that isn't preachy. When you accept the idea that you can look at it from any way you want, because I wanted to tell that tale. I wanted to tell the tale of, well, this thing happens, and people either believe it happened or they don't, and that affects their lives. How they relate to that event affects their lives. And that's the story in Emery's Gift. It was really my pleasure to write it.
Mm. Another best-selling book you had, A Dog's Purpose, is now being made into a film. Are you involved with that?
Yeah. We're talking about A Dog's Purpose, the movie, and DreamWorks hired me and also hired my wife, who is a screenwriter, to write the screenplay. And so we have sent that in, and they are doing whatever it is they do over there, where they are having meetings and discussing budgets and passing pieces of paper back and forth. But you know, we're just waiting anxiously to hear for the day when they start filming.
Well, how did you decide to write that book from the pooch's point of view?
Well, it goes all the way back to, as I was saying earlier, I used to live in Colorado, and I was on my mountain bike, and I met a dog in the mountains. He was behind a fence, so I couldn't really play with him, but I always stop and talk to the dog. Why not? I mean, it's a lot of fun. So I met a dog. I was talking to the dog, and the way the dog looked at me and interacted with me so reminded me of my very first dog, who was named Cammy, my dog when I was just 8 years old. And as I rode away, I thought to myself, what if that was Cammy? What if dogs are reborn and remember their lives, and he remembers me? And I thought, and what would that look like from the dog's perspective? And that is how A Dog's Purpose came to be. I started thinking about it from the dog's perspective, and it grew into a novel called A Dog's Purpose.
Well, I know that millions of people love that book, including me. All right, what's next? What book are you working on next?
Well, the good news, I guess, is that I've got a sequel to A Dog's Purpose coming out next May. It'll be called A Dog's Journey, and it'll be out in May of 2012. And then I've got another book that I'm working on right now that's got a code name. That means I haven't decided on a title.
Okay.
It's also dog-themed. Mm-hmm. I'm not planning to spend my entire career writing about dogs, but I love dogs, and people seem to expect dog books from me. That's probably what I'll write on next. I would just love to invite your listeners to come to our fan page if they're on Facebook. They just look for A Dog's Purpose on Facebook, and we have close to 100,000 fans talking about dogs, posting dog stories and dog pictures, and it's a really great community. It's not all about the book, A Dog's Purpose. It's mostly about just people, you know, celebrating our canine friends. They're welcome to come. If they want to nominate their dog for Dog of the Week, they can do so at adogspurpose.com. Adogspurpose.com is where I've got a website set up where we do the same sort of thing as on the fan page on Facebook, but it's a little more structured, and there's a place where you can upload your dog's picture. And every week, the winner of adogspurpose.com Dog of the Week gets a free copy of A Dog's Purpose.
Oh, that's great. Bruce, thanks so much for being with us today. I love your writing.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Again, for a sample of Bruce's bestsellers, go to archived shows at bookreportradio.com. You'll find A Dog's Purpose there, week of December 11th, 2010, and Emery's Gift, week of September 24th, 2011. Celebrated crime master James Lee Burke returns with Feast Day of Fools, a gorgeously crafted, brutally resonant chronicle of violence along the Texas-Mexico border. Sheriff Hackberry Holland patrols a small southwest Texas border town, meting out punishment and delivering justice in his small square of land. When an alcoholic ex-boxer named Danny Boy Lorca begs to be locked up after witnessing a man tortured to death by a group of bandits, Hack and his deputy, Pam Tibbs, slowly extract the Indian man's gruesome tale. It becomes clear that the desert contains a multitude of criminals, including serial murderer preacher Jack Collins, whom the New York Times has called one of Burke's most inspired villains. Collins' investigation leads him to Anton Ling, a mysterious Chinese woman whose steely demeanor and aristocratic beauty compel Hackberry to return to her home again and again as the investigation unfolds. Reviewers say James Lee Burke is at his engrossing and atmospheric best in this, his 13th novel, and Will Patton is getting raves for his narration.
Mobs did not rush across town to do good deeds. And in Hackberry's view, there was no more odious taint on any social or political endeavor than universal approval. To Hackberry, Danny Boy's alcoholic madness was a respite from a far greater form of delusion. It was late on a Wednesday night in April when Danny Boy walked out into the desert with an empty duffel bag and an army surplus entrenching tool, the sky as black as soot, the southern horizon pulsing with electricity that resembled gold wires, the softness of the ground crumbling under his cowboy boots, as though he were treading across the baked shell of an enormous riparian environment that had been layered and beveled and smoothed with a sculptor's knife. At the base of a mesa, he folded the entrenching tool into the shape of a hoe and knelt down and began digging in the ground, scraping through the remains of fossilized leaves and fish and birds that others said were millions of years old. In the distance, an igneous flash spread silently through the clouds, flaring in great yellow pools, lighting the desert floor and the cactus and mesquite and the greenery that was trying to bloom along a riverbed that never held water except during the monsoon season. Just before the light died, Danny Boy saw six men advancing across the plain toward him. Like figures caught inside the chemical mix of a half-developed photograph, their torsos slung with rifles. He scraped harder in the dirt, trenching a circle around what appeared to be two tapered, soft-nosed rocks protruding from the incline below the mesa. Then his E-tool broke through an armadillo's burrow. He inverted the handle and stuck it down the hole and wedged the earth upward until the burrow split across the top and he could work his hand deep into the hole, up to the elbow, and feel the shapes of the clustered objects that were as pointed and hard as calcified dugs. The night air was dense with an undefined feral odor like cougar scat and a sun-bleached carcass and burnt animal hair and water that had gone stagnant in a sandy drainage traced with the crawl lines of reptiles. The wind blew between the hills in the south, and he felt its coolness and the dampness of the rain mist on his face. He saw the leaves on the mesquite ripple like green lace, the mesas and buttes shimmering whitely against the clouds, then disappearing into the darkness again. He smelled the pinyon and juniper and the scent of delicate flowers that bloomed only at night and whose petals dropped off and clung to the rocks at sunrise like translucent pieces of colored rice paper. He stared at the southern horizon but saw no sign of the six men carrying rifles. He wiped his mouth on his sleeve and went back to work, scooping out a big hole around the stone-like objects that were welded together as tightly as concrete. The first shot was a tiny pop, like a wet firecracker exploding. He stared into the fine mist swirling through the hills. Then the lightning flared again, and he saw the armed men stenciled against the horizon and the silhouettes of two other figures who had broken from cover and were running toward the north, toward Danny Boy, toward a place that should have been safe from the criminality and violence that he believed was threading its way out of Mexico into his life. He lifted the nest of stony egg-shaped artifacts from the earth and slid them into the duffel bag and pulled the cord tight through the brass eyelets at the top. He headed back toward his house, staying close to the bottom of the mesa, avoiding the tracks he had made earlier, which he knew the armed men would eventually see and follow. Then a bolt of lightning exploded on top of the mesa, lighting the floodplain and the willows along the dry stream bed and the arroyos and crevices and caves in the hillsides as brightly as the sun. He plunged down a ravine, holding the duffel bag and e-tool at his sides for balance. He crouched behind a rock, hunching against it, his face turned toward the ground so it would not reflect light. He heard someone running past him in the darkness, someone whose breath was not only labored, but desperate, and used up, and driven by fear rather than a need for oxygen.
That was Feast Day of Fools by James Lee Burke. No matter who is doing the writing, Hollywood star or DC diplomat, good writing is crucial to good listening. Don't we know it? My guest today, Vic DeGenti, is going to fill us in on the tools of the trade, character archetypes, shapeshifters, and point of view. Serious writers and or novices, listen up. Welcome, Vic. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Elaine.
Let's talk right away about your new book. I know it has had an interesting publication evolution. Talk about that and talk about what made you write it.
Matanzas Bay is a new mystery suspense novel that I've published under the name Parker Francis. And you're right, it did have a long evolution. I actually started this back in 2005, and it won several awards before it was even published. It won the Josiah Bancroft Award in 2007 that was judged by David Poirier, noted author. And David was very, very valuable in giving me some great critiques, which I used in future rewrites. And then in 2009, it won the Royal Palm Literary Award that the Florida Writers Conference Association does. And it won the Best Mystery. And then it was selected as the Book of the Year in the unpublished category. And from that award, I was able to get an agent, and we shopped it all around and finally decided that the best route would be for me to go ahead and publish the book myself, which I did, and it's done very well as both an ebook and a print book as well. And it's totally different than my other three books that I've written, which I call adventure fantasies, and they have a different kind of a protagonist. Those books all have a cat as a protagonist, and this is a contemporary murder mystery. It's set in St. Augustine, Florida.
Now, first, why the decision to write under a pen name?
Well, that's a good question. I get that all the time. And I guess the main reason is that my Windrusher trilogy, the cat books, have a lot of very young readers. Not very, very young, but, you know, middle grade on up. And I just didn't want to confuse that with these new series I was doing, which are definitely adult murder mysteries. And so I thought one way to do that would be to write them under a pen name. But I've been telling all of my readers of the Windrusher books about the mystery, and many of them have gone out and bought it. The adults have.
All right. Now, I know this story is very compelling and multi-layered. How did you conceive the story?
Well, it's interesting because I was actually writing the second in my Windrusher series when an image of this character that I'd written for the second Windrusher book, Windrusher and the Cave of Thohoth, in which my feline protagonist is catnapped from his backyard and taken all the way to the south of California. And the family hires a private detective to try and find this cat. And that character was Quint Mitchell, who is the main character in Matanzas Bay. Well, in fleshing out Quint's resume, I gave him an interest in archaeology. And it never really came into play during that Windrusher book. But as I was writing, I had this image of Quint digging up this body while on an archaeological survey. And I kept pushing it away and pushing it away and kept writing the Windrusher book. And finally, when I finished that book, I started thinking about it and asking myself some of those what-if questions. And Matanzas Bay was the end result of it. And this book starts out with Quint helping his friend, the city archaeologist of St. Augustine, in a survey right in the downtown area, historical district. And he indeed unearths the body of the St. Augustine vice mayor. And so after that, things really take off, as you can imagine.
Here at the conference, you gave us a talk on heroes, mentors, and shapeshifters. Okay, what are the top five tips you'd share with writers on how to grow and develop characters?
Well, this particular workshop was based on Christopher Vogler's book, The Writer's Journey. And we went through in the workshop the various stages of the writer's journey from the departure to the call to adventure and moving on. And then we talked a good bit about seven basic archetypes. And from the hero to the mentor, the herald, the trickster, the shapeshifter, and the shadow. And one of the main points I was getting across is, as these character archetypes are not necessarily restricted to one character, but they should be looked at as masks, as any character could wear. So your hero at any time could be a mentor to another character, or could take on a trickster persona, or even a shadow when he's doing something he shouldn't do.
What is a shapeshifter?
A shapeshifter is a character, an archetypal character that basically causes confusion, that the hero, the protagonist, can't really get a grasp on it. And often the shapeshifter is of the female gender. And if you have a male hero, that's taken for granted because men don't know anything about women, right? So we don't understand them. So a lot of times in noir books, you know, the Maltese Falcon, the Big Sleep, in movies, Body Heat, Chinatown. The shapeshifter is a female character who is throughout most of it is looked at one way, and at the end turns out to be actually the villain, if you will.
Oh. Now, there are classic archetypes, but in our day and age, are there more modern archetypes?
Oh, certainly, because the archetypes that Vogler writes about can be brought into contemporary times very easily. Again, they're just basically masks that any character can wear.
And with your sort of evolution and story from, you know, creation to publication, what are the top three tips you'd share with an aspiring writer who wants to get something published?
Well, before any writer can think about publishing, they have to learn their craft. I think it was Ray Bradbury who said the first million words don't count, which means you have to do a lot of writing, do a lot of reading, see what really works. So work on your craft. Come to terrific writers' conferences like the Florida Writers Association conference. Attend workshops in your area. Read how-to books and write. Write a lot. And the more you write, the better you'll get. And, you know, writing is a craft, a learned craft like anything else. So that's what I'd say. So once you master the craft, or probably we never master it, but get better at it, that's when you can start thinking about getting an agent, finding an editor, an acquiring editor, a publishing house, etc. Too many people, especially now with e-publishing that's taken off so well, want to jump right in and start selling. And so they independently publish for Kindle or for the Nook, and they're very disappointed by the results because what they have put out there for the world to see is something that is maybe a beginning writer would do. And you can't fool the readers. Even if you're giving it away free or for 99 cents, you get a couple of those one-star reviews just ripping your writing, you know, you might as well call it quits.
Well, that's really sage advice. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Vic.
Thank you, Elaine. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be on your program.
Okay, for the geeks on your list and those who love design and reading, fonts surround us every day on street signs and buildings, on movie posters and books, and every product we buy. But where do they come from and why do we need so many? In Just My Type, a book about fonts, Simon Garfield faces the typefaces and shares all kinds of great info. For example, who is responsible for the staid practicality of Times New Roman, the cool anonymity of Arial, or the irritating levity of Comic Sans? Typefaces are now 560 years old, but we barely knew their names until about 20 years ago when the pull-down font menus on our first computers made us all the gods of type. Beginning in the early days of Gutenberg and ending with the most adventurous digital fonts, Simon Garfield explores the rich history and subtle powers of type. He goes on to investigate a range of modern mysteries, including how Helvetica took over the world, what inspires Trajan on bad movie posters, and why the T in the Beatles logo is longer than the other letters. Just My Type's cheeky irreverence will charm you, Gildert Jackson narrates.
I fell in love with comic books very early on, totally mesmerized not only by their combinations of words and pictures, but also by the aesthetics and moral codes of superheroes. But later, once I became a graphic designer specializing in book covers, it never occurred to me that my design sense was influenced by the comics in any way. After all, at Alfred A. Knopf, my employer of 25 years and counting, I was designing for real literature, some of the best of its kind, novels, biography, poetry and non-fiction worthy of the National Book Award, the Pulitzer, and the Nobel Prize. Surely the comics, as much as I loved them, were not affecting how I approached this realm. Or so I thought for many years, until during an interview one day I was asked this very question: did I think that comic books were a strong influence on my design sense? When I answered in the firm negative, the astute interviewer, I can't remember who or for what, replied that he begged to differ. "What do you mean?" I asked. "Well," he said, "in a lot of your jacket designs, the type and image are very much compartmentalized." "That's true." "As in the Cormac McCarthy jackets for the Border Trilogy." "Yes, I call that approach separation of type and state." "Okay, but you know what that also is?" "What?" "It's a comic book panel." "What?" "Sure, think about it. In comics, the images and words are strenuously kept apart. There's a caption at the top, boxed off from the drawing, and all the dialogue and thoughts of the characters are contained in balloons. You do that with a lot of your designs, don't you think?" For once, I was speechless. He was totally right. "I'll have to think about that," I said. As a kid who grew up in the 70s, my emotional experience with logotypes was regularly developed through television. The anticipation of seeing my favorite shows was always heightened by the opening credits, along with the theme songs, but that's another story. I realized that none of this would be considered classically good typography, which I wouldn't really learn about until college. At the time, I had no concept of what kitsch was, but I did know if a program was good or not, so if one believes that a piece of graphic design is only as good as the content it represents, then I'd say many, including the opening credits to I Love Lucy, The Brady Bunch, and Batman, are brilliant. As you could have told from the drawings on the back cover of my 8th grade English Lit notebook, the logos of rock bands were of particular interest, as they tend to be to the youth of America and the world in general. Alas, my taste in music was regrettable, but that would change soon enough. The main point is that while I understood that these symbols were specifically created for their respective entities, I did not yet understand that they represented graphic design. That would not happen until I went to Penn State University and majored in graphic design as an undergraduate. Peter Saville's album covers for Manchester's Factory Records in the 80s and 90s were a true revelation to me, especially his work for New Order. When I was a sophomore in college, the group soon became one of my favorites and remains so to this day. But what was truly striking was that while they were more or less a rarefied synth disco band, though a truly great one, Saville's cool and classically modernist sleeves didn't reflect at all any of the expected visual clichés of dance music. No mirror balls, no platform shoes, no groovy lettering, and most notably, no discernible emotion. The result, is a brilliantly nuanced balancing act between form and content, in which one is so totally at odds with the other that they ultimately complement each other with unique juxtaposition.
That was Just My Type by Simon Garfield. And for the boomers on your holiday list, Fear and Loathing at Rolling Stone, the essential writing of Hunter S. Thompson. Jan Wenner, the outlawed journalist's friend and editor for nearly 35 years, has assembled articles that begin with Thompson's infamous run for sheriff of Aspen on the freak party ticket in 1970 and ends with his final piece on the Bush-Kerry showdown of 2004. In between is Thompson's remarkable coverage of the 1972 presidential campaign, plus encounters with Muhammad Ali, Bill Clinton, and a lengthy excerpt from his acknowledged masterpiece, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Woven throughout is selected correspondence between Wenner and Thompson, most of it never before published. It traces the evolution of a personal and professional relationship that helped redefine modern journalism. As Thompson himself was prone to say, buy the ticket, take the ride. Phil Gigante narrates.
After Hunter's death, we produced a special tribute issue of Rolling Stone based on memories and vignettes from nearly 100 of his friends, colleagues, and co-conspirators. It took 10 days, with a half dozen editors working around the clock against a hellacious deadline. And once again, we were in service to Hunter S. Thompson, busting our asses on his behalf. He had again touched us in some magical, unforgettable way, even affecting those on our staff who had never met him. That special issue was commissioned as a full-length book, Gonzo, The Life of Hunter S. Thompson, a 150,000-word oral history. For now, it stands as the definitive Hunter S. Thompson biography and an essential companion to any understanding of his work and life. I edited it, word by word, with much devotion. I've always thought that Hunter had, in a sense, written his own autobiography in the pages of Rolling Stone, and that if there was a way to take his collected work and edit it properly, there would emerge a narrative of Hunter's great and wild life, a story about himself, who was, after all, his own greatest character. This notion was among the things I discussed with Paul Scanlon, who was my trusted right-hand man and managing editor for many of our San Francisco years, when we sat down to edit this book. Paul knows the Rolling Stone lore thoroughly, was a tasteful and meticulous editor, and was a natural to work with me on this comprehensive look at Hunter's years with the magazine. We've also included some correspondence between Hunter S. Thompson and me, actually a very small sample, as well as a couple of thoughtful and hilarious memos to the staff that bring yet another subtext and flavor to the arc of his work. Hunter lived a great life of genius, talent, and righteousness. It is reflected in these pages. Introduction. Paul Scanlon. When I first met Hunter S. Thompson in 1971, I didn't know what to expect. I was familiar with his work, of course, and had read the wonderful account of his campaign to become sheriff of Pitkin County, Aspen, Colorado, in the pages of Rolling Stone. He had been in Los Angeles working on a piece about the murder of newspaperman Reuben Salazar. There had been talk, very vague talk, about his writing something about Las Vegas. Then one fine spring day he appeared in Rolling Stone's San Francisco office. For me and the magazine, nothing would ever be quite the same. If you were a progressively minded college student in the 1960s, certain books were required reading. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest by Ken Kesey, A Confederate General from Big Sur, and Trout Fishing in America by Richard Brautigan. The Candy-Colored Tangerine Flake Streamline Baby and The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe. And Hell's Angels by Hunter S. Thompson. As an undergraduate majoring in journalism, I was drawn to the writing of Wolfe and a few others who were practicing what was not yet being called the new journalism. It's funny, but even at an uber-liberal school like San Francisco State, there was a schism, what was known in the day as a generation gap, between faculty and students over this new kind of writing. Our professors considered Wolfe and his ilk posers, inspiring some kind of journalistic vaudeville by applying fictional techniques to reporting. We thought our instructors intended to mold us into drones, destined to carve out careers at small-town dailies. I guess it was my junior year when I pulled a copy of The Nation from the student lounge magazine rack and had my first encounter with the writing of Hunter Thompson. It was the first of his two-part report on traveling with the Hells Angels. The Outlaw Motorcycle Club's Oakland chapter was a fixture in the Bay Area. Encountering a group of angels was not uncommon, especially after they embraced LSD and began hanging out at dance rock concerts in places like the Fillmore Auditorium in Winterland. Big Brother and the Holding Company became their official band. The rule of thumb was simple if you were nearby. Keep your distance and try not to make eye contact. Even in their brief, acid-drenched, benign phase, the angels were downright scary, clearly capable of unpredictable violence. So it was a revelation to me that there was a writer who could figure out a way to win their trust and run with these characters. Hunter Thompson clearly had the smarts and the courage to do so. Or he was a hell of a salesman and a little bit crazy. Whatever. That early installment in The Nation convinced me he was the real deal. Later that day, I wondered aloud to my fellow campus newspaper staffers what our faculty advisors would make of him.
That was Fear and Loathing at Rolling Stone by Hunter Thompson. Robert Massey, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Peter the Great, Nicholas and Alexandra, and the Romanoffs, returns with another masterpiece of narrative biography, Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman. This is the extraordinary story of an obscure young German princess who traveled to Russia at 14 and rose to become one of the most powerful and captivating women in history. Born into a minor noble family, Catherine transformed herself into Empress of Russia by sheer determination. Possessing a brilliant mind and an insatiable curiosity as a young woman, she devoured the works of Enlightenment philosophers and, when she reached the throne, attempted to use their principles to guide her rule of the vast and backward Russian Empire. She knew or corresponded with preeminent historical figures of her time, Voltaire, Diderot, Frederick the Great, Empress Maria Therese of Austria, Marie Antoinette, and surprisingly, the American naval hero, John Paul Jones. Determined to become the embodiment of the benevolent despot, she found herself always contending with the deeply ingrained realities of Russian life, including serfdom. She persevered, and for 34 years, the government, foreign policy, cultural development, and welfare of the Russian people were in her hands. She dealt with domestic rebellion, foreign wars, and the tidal wave of political change and violence churned up by the French Revolution that swept across Europe. Mark Deakins narrates.
Here, in the most sumptuously magnificent court in North Germany, she had become accustomed to a life of beautiful clothes, sophisticated company, balls, operas, concerts, fireworks, hunting parties, and constant tittering gossip. Her new husband, Christian Augustus, a career officer existing on his meager army pay, could provide none of this. The best he could manage was a modest gray stone house on a cobbled street constantly swept by wind and rain. The walled fortress town of Stettin, overlooking a bleak northern sea and dominated by a rigid military atmosphere, was not a place where gaiety, graciousness, or any of the social refinements could flourish. Garrison wives led dull lives. The lives of the wives of the town were duller still. And here, a lively young woman, fresh from the luxury and distractions of the court of Brunswick, was asked to exist on a tiny income with a puritanical husband who was devoted to soldiering, addicted to rigid economy, equipped to give orders but not to converse, and eager to see his wife succeed in the enterprise for which he had married her, the bearing of an heir. In this endeavor, Johanna did her best. She was a dutiful, if unhappy, wife. But always underneath, she yearned to be free. Free of her boring husband, free of their relative penury, free of the narrow provincial world of Stettin. Always, she was certain that she deserved something better. And then, 18 months after her marriage, she had a baby. Johanna, at 16, was unprepared for the realities of motherhood. She had dealt with her pregnancy by wrapping herself in dreams, that her children would grow into extensions of herself, and that their lives eventually would supply the broad avenue on which she would travel to achieve her own ambitions. In these dreams, she took it for granted that the baby she was carrying, her firstborn, would be a son, an heir for his father, but more important, a handsome and exceptional boy whose brilliant career she would guide and ultimately share. At 2:30 a.m. on April 21, 1729, in the chill gray atmosphere of a Baltic dawn, Johanna's child was born. Alas, the little person was a daughter. Johanna and a more accepting Christian Augustus managed to give the baby a name, Sophia Augusta Frederica. But from the beginning, Johanna could not find or express any maternal feeling. She did not nurse or caress her little daughter. She spent no time watching over her cradle or holding her. Instead, abruptly, she handed the child over to servants and wet nurses. One explanation may be that the process of childbirth nearly cost Johanna her life. For 19 weeks after Sophia was born, the adolescent mother remained confined to her bed. A second is that Johanna was still very young, and her own bright ambitions in life were far from fulfilled. But the stark underlying reason was that her child was a girl, not a boy. Ironically, although she could not know it then, the birth of this daughter was the crowning achievement of Johanna's life. Had the baby been the son she so passionately desired, and had he lived to adulthood, he would have succeeded his father as Prince of Anhalt-Zerbst. Then the history of Russia would have been different, and the small niche in history that Johanna Elizabeth earned for herself never would have existed. 18 months after the birth of her first child, Johanna gave birth to the son upon whom she had set her heart. Her fondness for this second infant, Wilhelm Christian, became all the more intense when she realized that something about the child was seriously wrong. The boy, who appeared to suffer from rickets, became her obsession. She petted him, spoiled him, and scarcely let him out of her sight, lavishing on him all the affection she had denied her daughter. Sophia, already keenly aware that her own birth had been a disappointment to her mother, now observed the love with which Johanna surrounded her little brother. Gentle kisses, whispered endearments, tender caresses all were bestowed on the boy, while Sophia watched. It is, of course, common for the mother of a handicapped or chronically ill child to spend more time with that child, just as it is normal for other children in the family to resent this disproportionate attention. But Johanna's rejection of Sophia began before Wilhelm's birth, and then continued in aggravated form.
That was Catherine the Great by Robert Massey. On November 22, 1963, three shots rang out in Dallas. President Kennedy died and the world changed. What if you could change it back? In this brilliantly conceived tour de force, 11-22-63, Stephen King takes listeners on an incredible journey into the past and the possibility of altering it. It begins with Jake Epping, a 35-year-old English teacher in Lisbon Falls, Maine, who makes extra money teaching GED classes. He asks his students to write about an event that changed their lives. One essay blows him away, a gruesome true story about the night more than 50 years ago when his student Harry Dunning's father came home and killed his mother, his sister, and his brother with a sledgehammer. Not much later, Jake's friend Al, who owns the local diner, divulges a secret. His storeroom is a portal to the past, a particular day in 1958. And Al enlists Jake to take over the mission that has become his obsession, to prevent the Kennedy assassination. So begins Jake's new life as George Amberson in a different world of Ike and JFK and Elvis, big American cars and sock hops and cigarette smoke everywhere. From the dank little city of Derry, Maine, to the warm-hearted town of Jody, Texas, where Jake falls dangerously in love, every turn is leading, of course, to a troubled loner named Lee Harvey Oswald, and to Dallas, where the past becomes heart-stoppingly suspenseful, and where history might not be history anymore. Time travel has never been so believable or so terrifying. Craig Wasson narrates.
Harry Dunning graduated with flying colors. I went to the little GED ceremony in the LHS gym at his invitation. He really had no one else, and I was happy to do it. After the benediction, spoken by Father Bandy, who rarely missed an LHS function, I made my way through the milling friends and relatives to where Harry was standing alone in his billowy black gown, holding his diploma in one hand and his rented mortarboard in the other. I took his hat so I could shake his hand. He grinned exposing a set of teeth with many gaps and several leaners, but a sunny and engaging grin for all that. "Thanks for coming, Mr. Epping. Thanks so much. It was my pleasure, and you can call me Jake. It's a little perk I accord to students who are old enough to be my father." He looked puzzled for a minute, then laughed. "I guess I am, ain't I? Jeez." I laughed too. Lots of people were laughing all around us. And there were tears, of course. What's hard for me comes easily to a great many people. "And that A+, jeez, I never got an A+ in my whole life. Never expected one either." "You deserved it, Harry. So, what's the first thing you're going to do as a high school graduate?" His smile dimmed for a second. This was a prospect he hadn't considered. "I guess I'll go back home. I got a little house I ran on Goddard Street, you know." He raised the diploma, holding it carefully by the fingertips as if the ink might smear. "I'll frame this and hang it on the wall. Then I guess I'll pour myself a glass of wine and sit on the couch and just admire it until bedtime." "Sounds like a plan," I said. "But would you like to have a burger and some fries with me first? We could go down to Al's." I expected a wince at that, but of course I was judging Harry by my colleagues, not to mention most of the kids we taught. They avoided Al's like the plague and tended to patronize either the Dairy Queen across from the school or the Hi-Hat out on 196, near where the old Lisbon drive-in used to be.
"That'd be great, Mr. Epping. Thanks."
"Jake, remember?"
"Jake, you bet."
So I took Harry to Al's, where I was the only faculty regular, and although he actually had a waitress that summer, Al served us himself. As usual, a cigarette, illegal in public eating establishments, but that never stopped Al, smoldered in one corner of his mouth, and the eye on that side squinted against the smoke. When he saw the folded-up graduation robe and realized what the occasion was, he insisted on picking up the check. What check there was. The meals at Al's were always remarkably cheap, which had given rise to rumors about the fate of certain stray animals in the vicinity. He also took a picture of us, which he later hung on what he called the town wall of celebrity. Other celebrities represented included the late Albert Dunton, founder of Dunton Jewelry, Earl Higgins, a former LHS principal, John Crafts, founder of John Crafts Auto Sales, and of course Father Bandy of St. Cyril's. The father was paired with Pope John XXIII, the latter not local, but revered by Al Templeton, who called himself a good Catholic. The picture Al took that day showed Harry Dunning with a big smile on his face. I was standing next to him, and we were both holding his diploma. His tie was pulled slightly askew. I remember that because it made me think of those little squiggles he put on the ends of his lowercase y's. I remember it all. I remember it very well. 2 years later, on the last day of the school year, I was sitting in that very same teacher's room and reading my way through a batch of final essays my American Poetry Honors Seminar had written. The kids themselves had already left, turned loose for another summer, and soon I would do the same. But for the time being, I was happy enough where I was, enjoying the unaccustomed quiet.
We've just heard 11-22-63 by Stephen King. Readers, please take time out of your busy season to relax, put up your feet, and dive into a great book. Let's convene again next week, where I'll have another gift bag of great titles for you, for your friends and your loved ones. And if you need some midweek shopping inspiration, refer to titles you'll find on my website, www.bookreportradio.com. It's a grab bag of literary goodies. See you next week on The Book Report.